Airwalking is the name given to the skateboarding move where the skater takes off from a ramp, slips his board out from under his feet, and then takes one or two long, exaggerated strides in the air before landing. It's a classic stunt, a staple of traditional skateboarding, which is why when two entrepreneurs decided to start an athletic shoe manufacturer aimed at hardcore skateboarders in the mid-1980s, they called the company Airwalk. Airwalk was based outside of San Diego and rooted in the teenage beach and skate culture of the region. In the beginning, the firm made a canvas shoe in wild colors and prints that became a kind of alternative fashion statement. They also made a technical skate shoe in suede, with a thick sole and heavily cushioned upper that was so badly made, at least at first, that it was almost as stiff as the skateboard itself. But the skaters became so devoted to the product that they would wash the shoes over and over again and then drive over them in cars to break them in. Airwalk was cool. They sponsored professional skateboarders and developed a cult following at the skate events, and after a few years had built up a comfortable $13 million a year business. Companies can continue at that level indefinitely, in a state of low-level equilibrium, serving a small but loyal audience. But Airwalk wanted more. They wanted to build themselves into an international brand. And so in the early 1990s, they changed course. They reorganized their business operations. They redesigned their shoes. They expanded their focus to include not just skateboarding, but also surfing, snowboarding, mountain biking, and BMX bicycle racing, sponsoring riders in all of those sports, and making Airwalk synonymous with the active, alternative lifestyle. They embarked on an aggressive grassroots campaign to meet the buyers for youth-oriented shoe stores. They convinced Foot Locker to try them out on an experimental basis. They worked to get alternative rock bands to wear their shoes on stage, and, perhaps most importantly, they decided to hire a small advertising agency named Lambesis to rethink their marketing campaign. Under the direction of Lambesis, Airwalk exploded. In 1993, they had been a $60 million company. In 1994, they had sales of $44 million. In 1995, they jumped to $150 million. And the year after that, they had $175 million. At their peak, Airwalk was ranked by one major marketing company as the 13th coolest brand among teenagers in the world, and the number 3 footwear brand behind Nike and Adidas. Somehow, within the space of a year or two, Airwalk was jolted out of its quiet equilibrium on the beaches of Southern California. In the mid-1990s, Airwalk tipped. Why did Airwalk tip? The short answer is that Lambesis came up with an inspired advertising campaign. At the start, working with only a small budget, the creative director of Lambesis, Chad Farmer, came up with a series of dramatic images. Single photographs showing the Airwalk user relating to his shoes in some weird way. In one, a young man is wearing an Airwalk shoe on his head, with the laces hanging down like braids, as his laces are being cut by a barber. In another, a leather-clad girl is holding up a shiny vinyl Airwalk shoe like a mirror, and using it to apply lipstick. The ads were put on billboards and in wild postings on construction site walls and in alternative magazines. As Airwalk grew, Lambesis went into television. In one of the early Airwalk commercials, the camera pans across a bedroom floor littered with discarded clothing. It then settles under the bed as the air is filled with grunting and puffing and noise of the bedsprings going up and down. Finally, the camera comes out from under the bed and we see a young, slightly dazed-looking youth holding an Airwalk shoe in his hand, jumping up and down on his bed as he tries unsuccessfully to kill a spider on the ceiling. The ads were entirely visual, designed to appeal to youth all over the world. They had a specific sensibility. They all featured a truculent, slightly geeky anti-hero. And they were funny in a sophisticated way. This was great advertising. And in the years since the first Airwalk ads appeared, the look and feel of that campaign has been copied again and again by other companies trying to capture the cool sensibility. The strength of the Lambesis campaign was in more than the look of their work, though. Airwalk tipped because its advertising was founded very explicitly on the principles of epidemic transmission. Perhaps the best way to understand what Lambesis did is to go back to what sociologists call the diffusion model, which is a detailed academic way of looking how a contagious idea or product or innovation moves through a population. One of the most famous diffusion studies is Bruce Ryan and Neil Gross's analysis of the spread of hybrid seed corn in Greene County, Iowa in the 1930s. The new corn seed was introduced in Iowa in 1928, and it was superior in every respect to the seed that had been used by farmers for decades before. But it wasn't adopted all at once. Of the 259 farmers studied by Ryan and Gross, only a handful had started planting the new seed by 1932 and 1933. In 1934, 16 took the plunge. In 1935, 21 followed, then 36, and the year after that a whopping 61, and then 46, 36, 14, and 3, until by 1941, all but two of the 259 farmers studied were using the new seeds. In the language of diffusion research, the handful of farmers who started trying hybrid seed at the very beginning of the 1930s were the innovators, the adventurous ones. The slightly larger group who were infected by them were the early adopters. They were the opinion leaders in the community, the respected, thoughtful people who watched and analyzed what those wild innovators were doing and then followed suit. Then came the big bulge of farmers in 1936, 1937, and 1938, the early majority and the late majority, the deliberate and the skeptical mass, who would never try anything until the most respected of farmers had tried it first. They caught the seed virus and passed it on, finally, to the laggards, the most traditional of all, who saw no urgent reason to change. If you plot that progression on a graph, it forms a perfect epidemic curve. Starting slowly, tipping just as the early adopters start using the seed, then rising sharply as the majority catches on, before falling away at the end when the laggards come straggling in. What Lambesis did with their campaign for Airwalk was to try to take a brand that had been worn entirely by innovators and run it through this diffusion process, introducing it to early adopters and then the early majority, and finally, when the shoes exploded, the late majority. This is easier said than done, of course. It doesn't take much to see that trying to get a pair of sneakers into the mainstream in a market crowded with sneakers is an awful lot more difficult than getting farmers to try an obviously superior type of hybrid seed. In fact, the closer you look at the diffusion model, the trickier the actual process of contagion begins to seem. Innovations don't just slide effortlessly from one group to the next. There is a chasm between them. In the case of Hush Puppies, the downtown Manhattan kids who rediscovered the brand were wearing the shoes because Hush Puppies were identified with a dated, kitschy, ironic 50s image. They were wearing them precisely because no one else would wear them. What they were looking for in fashion was a revolutionary statement. They were willing to take risks in order to set themselves apart. But most of us in the early and late majority don't want to make a revolutionary statement or take risks with our fashion at all. So how on earth did Hush Puppies cross the chasm from one group to the next? You could say the same of Airwalk. Lambesis was given a shoe that had a very specific appeal to the Southern California skateboarding subculture. Their task was to make it hip and attractive to teenagers all over the world, even teens who had never skateboarded in their lives, who didn't think skateboarding was particularly cool, and who had no functional need for wide outsoles that could easily grip the board, and padded uppers to cushion the shocks of doing aerial stunts. That's clearly not an easy task. How did they do it? How is it that all the weird, idiosyncratic things that really cool kids do end up in the mainstream? This is where, I think, connectors, mavens, and salesmen play their most important role. In the section on the law of the few, I talked about how their special social gifts can cause epidemics to tip. Here, though, it is possible to be much more specific about what they do. They are the ones who make it possible for innovations to overcome this problem of the chasm. They are translators. They take ideas and information from one highly specialized world and translate them into a language the rest of us can understand. One of the key figures at the Lambesis advertising agency was Dee Dee Gordon, the firm's former head of market research, and she says that the same process occurs in the case of fashion trends that periodically sweep through youth culture. The innovators try something new. Then someone, the teen equivalent of a maven or a connector or a salesman, sees it and adopts it. Those kids make things more palatable for mainstream people. They see what the really wired kids are doing and they tweak it. They start doing it themselves, but they change it a bit. They make it more usable. Maybe there's a kid who rolls up his jeans and puts duct tape around the bottom because he's the one bike messenger in the school. Well, the translator likes that look, but he won't use tape. He'll buy something with Velcro. Or then there was the whole baby doll t-shirt thing. One girl starts wearing a shrunken down t-shirt. She goes to Toys R Us and buys the Barbie t-shirt. And the others say, that's so cool. But they might not get it so small, and they might not get it with Barbie on it. They look at it and say, it's a little off. But there's a way I can change it and make it okay. Then it takes off. If someone wants to start an epidemic then, whether it is of shoes or behavior, they have to somehow employ connectors, mavens, and salesmen. They have to find some person or some means to translate the message of the innovators into something the rest of us can understand. Lambesis's intention was to spread the word about Airwalk. Obviously, they couldn't directly identify the equivalent of mavens and connectors and salesmen. They were a tiny ad agency trying to put together an international campaign. What they could do, though, was start an epidemic in which their own ad campaign played the role of translator, serving as an intermediary between the innovators and everyone else. The first thing Lambesis did was to develop an in-house market research program aimed at the youth market that Airwalk wanted to conquer. To run their research division, Lambesis hired Dee Dee Gordon, who had previously worked for the Converse Athletic Shoe Company. Gordon, who was then in her mid-20s, had an uncanny ability to spot new trends. While she was at Converse, for example, she had noticed white teenage girls in Los Angeles dressing up like cholos, Mexican gangsters, with the look they called the wife beater, a tight white tank top with the bra strap hanging out, and long shorts and tube socks and shower sandals. I told them, this is going to hit, Gordon remembers. There are just too many people wearing it. We have to make a shower sandal. So they cut the back off a Converse sneaker, put a sandal outsole on it, and Converse sold 500,000 pairs. Gordon would come to New York and would sit watching the sidewalks of Soho in the East Village for hours, photographing anything unusual. Gordon was a maven for the elusive, indefinable quality known as cool. At Lambesis, Gordon's task was to take those instincts and institutionalize them. She developed a network of young, savvy correspondents in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and Dallas and Seattle and around the world in places like Tokyo and London to be her eyes and ears. These kids were innovators, trendsetters. They were the kinds of people who would have been wearing hush puppies in the East Village in the early 1990s. The success of her research depended entirely on her ability to spot these innovators, but Gordon quickly became adept at it. She has a tape, for example, of two interviews she did with two teenage girls. They are both asked the same questions about what they like and dislike, and at first it's hard to tell the difference between the two. But Gordon says that if you listen closely, it's clear that the second girl is the real thing, while the first girl is very mainstream. Girl 2's tastes are more considered. She pauses before she answers, Gordon says. She doesn't say the first thing that comes to her mind. It's important to her to be different. Girl 1 answers vaguely, not going into nearly the same detail as her counterpart. She buys her clothes at J. Crew, listens to rap music. The innovator listens to an incredibly obscure band, the Danielson Family, and names as her favorite designer Stephen Allen. Have you ever heard of Stephen Allen? The person she admires the most, Woody Allen, because he gets to do what he wants. These are kids who are outcasts in some way, Gordon says. It doesn't matter whether it's actually true. They feel that way. They always feel like they're different. If you ask kids what worries them, the trendsetter kids pick up on things like germ warfare or terrorism. They pick up on bigger picture things, whereas the mainstream kids think about being overweight or their grandparents dying or how well they're doing at school. You see more activists in trendsetters, people with more passion. I'm looking for someone who is an individual, who has definitely set herself apart from everybody else, who doesn't look like her peers. I've run into trendsetters who look completely like Joe Regular Guy. I can see Joe Regular Guy at a club listening to some totally hardcore band playing, and I say to myself, oh my God, what's that guy doing here? And that totally intrigues me, and I have to walk up to him and say, hey, you're really into this band, what's up? You know what I mean? I look at everything. If I see Joe Regular Guy sitting in a coffee shop and everyone around him has blue hair, I'm going to gravitate towards him because, hey, what's Joe Regular Guy doing in a coffee shop with people with blue hair? With that stable of innovator correspondents in place, Gordon would then go back to them 2 or 3 or 4 times a year, asking them what music they were listening to, what television shows they were watching, what clothes they were buying, or what their goals and aspirations were. The data was not always coherent. It required interpretation. Different ideas would pop up in different parts of the country, then sometimes move east or west or sometimes west to east. But by looking at the big picture, by comparing the data from Austin to Seattle and Seattle to Los Angeles and Los Angeles to New York, and watching it change from one month to the next, Gordon was able to develop a kind of coherent picture of the rise and movement of new trends across the country. And by comparing what her innovators were saying and doing with what mainstream kids were saying and doing 3 months or 6 months or a year later, she was able to track what sorts of ideas were able to make the jump from the cool subcultures to the majority. Gordon's findings became the template for the Airwalk campaign. If she found new ideas or trends or concepts that were catching fire among innovators around the country, the firm would plant those same concepts in the Airwalk ads they were creating. Once, for example, Gordon picked up on the fact that trendsetters were developing a sudden interest in Tibet and the Dalai Lama. The influential rap band The Beastie Boys were very publicly putting money into the Free Tibet campaign and were bringing monks on stage at their concerts to give testimonials. The Beastie Boys pushed that through and made it okay, Gordon remembers. So Lambesis made a very funny Airwalk ad with a young Airwalk-wearing monk sitting at a desk in a classroom writing a test. He's looking down at his feet because he's written cheat notes on the side of his shoes. When a billboard version of the ad was put up in San Francisco, Lambesis was forced to take it down after Tibetan monks protested that monks don't touch their feet, let alone cheat on tests. When James Bond began popping up on the trendsetter radar, Lambesis hired the director of the James Bond movies to film a series of commercials, all of which featured airwalk-clad characters making wild escapes from faceless villains. To look through the inventory of airwalk ads in that critical period, in fact, is to get a complete guide to the fads and infatuations and interests of the youth culture of the era. There are 30-second spoofs of kung fu movies, a TV spot on beat poetry, an X-Files-style commercial in which a young man driving into Roswell, New Mexico, has his airwalks confiscated by aliens. There are 2 explanations for why this strategy of advertising was so successful. The first is obvious. Lambesis was picking on various, very contagious trends while they were still in their infancy. By the time their new ad campaign and the shoes to go along with it were ready, that trend, with luck, would just be hitting the mainstream. Lambesis, in other words, was piggybacking on social epidemics, associating airwalk with each new trend wave that swept through youth culture. It's all about timing, Gordon says. You follow the trendsetters. You see what they're doing. It takes a year to produce those shoes. By the time the year goes, if your trend is the right trend, it's going to hit those mainstream people at the right time. Lambesis wasn't just a passive observer in this process, however. It is also the case that their ads helped to create epidemics out of the ideas they were discovering among innovators. At times, it was their campaign that was providing the critical push that allowed certain trends to tip. Gordon says, for example, that when something fails to make it out of the trendsetter community into the mainstream, it's usually because the idea never took strong enough root in the culture. There aren't enough cues, she says. You didn't see it in music and film and art and fashion. Usually, if something's going to make it, you'll see that thread running through everything, through what they like on TV, what they want to listen to, even the materials they want to wear. It's everywhere. But if something doesn't make it, you'll only see it in one of those areas. Lambesis was taking certain ideas and helping them take root, planting them everywhere. Along the way, as well, they were providing that critical translation. Gordon's research showed that innovator kids were heavily into the Dalai Lama and all of the very serious issues raised by the occupation of Tibet. So what Lambesis did was take one very simple reference to that, a Tibetan monk, and put him in a funny, slightly cheeky situation. They tweaked it. Innovators were into kung fu movies. So Lambesis made a kung fu parody ad where the Airwalk hero fights off martial arts villains with his skateboard. Lambesis took the kung fu motif and merged it with youth culture. They took the cultural cues from the innovators, cues that the mainstream kids may have seen but not been able to make sense of, and assimilated them into a more coherent form. They gave those cues a specific meaning that they did not have previously, attached to them a specific sensibility, and packaged them in the form of a pair of shoes. It can hardly be a surprise that Airwalk tipped in 1995 and 1996. Lambesis wasn't just a passive observer in this process, however. It is also the case that their ads helped to create epidemics out of the ideas they were discovering among innovators. At times, it was their campaign that was providing the critical push that allowed certain trends to tip. The Airwalk epidemic did not last. In 1997, the sales of the company began to falter. They had production problems and had difficulty filling their orders. In critical locations, Airwalk failed to supply enough product for the back-to-school season, and their once loyal distributors began to turn against them. At the same time, the company began to lose that cutting-edge sensibility that it had traded on for so long. When Airwalk started, the product was directional and inventive. The shoes were very forward, said Chad Farmer. We maintained the trendsetter focus on the marketing, but the product began to slip. The company began to listen more and more to the sales staff, and the product started to get that homogenized, mainstream look. Everybody loved the marketing. In focus groups that we do, they still talk about how they miss it. But the number one complaint is, what happened to the cool product? Lambesis' whole strategy was based on translating innovator shoes for the majority. But suddenly, Airwalk wasn't an innovator shoe anymore. We made another critical mistake, Lee Smith, the former president of Airwalk, says. We had a segmentation strategy where the small, independent core skate shops, the 300 boutiques around the country who really created us, had a certain product line that was exclusive to them. They didn't want us to be in the mall. So what we did was we segmented our product. We said to the core shops, you don't have to compete with the malls. It worked out very well. The boutiques were given the technical shoes, different designs, better materials, more expensive uppers. Smith said, we had a special signature model, the Tony Hawk, for skateboarding, which was a lot beefier and more durable. It would retail for about $80. The shoes Airwalk distributed to Kinney's or Champs or Foot Locker, meanwhile, were less elaborate and would retail for about $60. The innovators always got to wear a different, more exclusive shoe than everybody else. The mainstream consumer had the satisfaction of wearing the same brand as the cool kids. But then, at the height of their success, Airwalk switched strategies. They stopped giving the specialty shops their own shoes. That's when the trendsetters started to get a disregard for the brand, says Farmer. They started to go to their boutiques where they got their cool stuff, and they realized that everyone else could get the very same shoes at JCPenney. Now, all of a sudden, Lambesis was translating mainstream products for the mainstream. The epidemic was over. Starting epidemics requires concentrating resources on a few key areas. The law of the few says that connectors, mavens, and salesmen are responsible for starting word-of-mouth epidemics, which means that if you are interested in starting a word-of-mouth epidemic, your resources ought to be solely concentrated on those three groups. No one else matters. We are also powerfully influenced by our surroundings, our immediate context, and the personalities of those around us. Taking the graffiti off the walls of New York's subways turned New Yorkers into better citizens. While there is difficulty and volatility in the world of the tipping point, there is a large measure of hopefulness as well. Merely by manipulating the size of a group, we can dramatically affect its receptivity to new ideas. By tinkering with the presentation of information, we can seriously improve its stickiness. Simply by finding and reaching those few special people who hold so much social power, we can shape the course of social epidemics. In the end, tipping points are a reaffirmation of the potential for change and the power of intelligent action. Look at the world around you. It may seem like an unmovable, implacable place. It is not. With the slightest push, in just the right place, it can be tipped. Afterward, tipping point lessons from the real world. Not long after The Tipping Point came out, I happened to talk to an epidemiologist, a man who had spent the better part of his professional life battling the AIDS epidemic. He was a thoughtful fellow and frustrated in the way that you can imagine someone would be who has had to deal on a daily basis with such a terrible disease. We were sitting in a cafe talking about my book, which he had read, and then he said something startling. I wonder if we would have been better off if we had never discovered the AIDS virus at all. I don't think he meant that literally, or that he regretted the countless lives that had been saved or prolonged by anti-HIV drugs and the AIDS test. What he meant was this, that the AIDS epidemic is fundamentally a social phenomenon. It spreads because of the beliefs and social structures and poverty and prejudices and personalities of a community, and sometimes getting caught up in the precise biological characteristics of a virus merely serves as a distraction. We might have halted the spread of AIDS far more effectively just by focusing on those beliefs and social structures and poverty and prejudices and personalities. And when he said that, a light bulb went on inside my head. That's what I was trying to say in The Tipping Point. A book, I was taught long ago in English class, is a living and breathing document that grows richer with each new reading. But I never quite believed that until I wrote The Tipping Point. I wrote my book without any clear expectation of who would read it, or what, if anything, it would be useful for. It seemed presumptuous to think otherwise. But in the years since its publication, I have been inundated with the comments of readers. I have received thousands of emails through my website, www.cloudwell.com. I have spoken at conferences and retreats and sales meetings and chatted with internet entrepreneurs and shoe designers and community activists and movie executives and countless others, and each time I have learned something new about my book and about why it seems to have touched such a chord. In New Jersey, the philanthropist Sharon Karmazin bought 300 copies of The Tipping Point and sent one to every public library in the state, promising to fund any ideas they could come up with that were inspired by my book. Use the thinking in the book to create something new, Karmazin told librarians. Don't just give us something you wanted to do anyway. Within a few months, Tipping Point grants totaling close to $100,000 have been given out to 21 different libraries. In Roselle, the public library is on a side street, hidden away behind shrubbery, and so the library got a grant to put up signs around town to direct people to the library. Another library used its grant to teach the connectors among the group of seniors who use the library to surf the net, betting that they will draw in other patrons. Still another library bought Spanish language books and materials, hoping to create a draw for an underserved population in their town. None of the grants was more than a few $1,000s, nor were the ideas themselves more than modest. But that was the point. In California, Ken Futternick, a professor of education at California State University at Sacramento, says he was inspired by the tipping point to come up with an idea for attracting teachers to troubled schools. "There is an interesting stalemate," Futternick told me. "Good principals say, I can't go off to a hard school unless I have good teachers. And good teachers say, I won't go off to a hard school unless there is a good principal." There have been a lot of efforts, like forgivable loans, that thrash around and don't ever go anywhere. In some schools in low-income parts of Oakland, where Futternick has been focusing his efforts, he says that 40% of the teachers may lack credentials, working only on an emergency two-year basis. I ask teachers, what would it take for you to go to one of these schools in a very low-income area, lots of single parents, not a safe part of town? He went on, salary incentives? They say maybe. Lower class size? They say yeah, maybe. All the things I listed were sort of attractive, but I didn't get the sense that any one of them would be enough to get people to take the assignment. It would be easy to conclude, from all of that, that teachers are undedicated and selfish, not willing to work in those places where they are most needed. But what would happen, Futternick wondered, if he changed the context of the request? His new idea, which he hopes to put in place over the next year in Oakland, is for principals to be recruited for difficult schools and then given a year to put together a team of qualified teachers drawn from good schools for their new assignment, a team that would go into the new school together. On playing fields and battlegrounds, challenges that would be daunting and impossible if faced alone are suddenly possible when tackled in a close-knit group. The people haven't changed, but the way in which the task appears to them has. Futternick thinks the same principle ought to hold true in the classroom, that teachers would be willing to take on a daunting assignment if they felt they were surrounded by other experienced, high-quality teachers. That's a lesson from the tipping point that I never thought could have application in the inner city of Oakland. One of the things that motivated me to write the tipping point was the mystery of word of mouth, a phenomenon that everyone seemed to agree was important, but no one seemed to know how to define. It is on this subject that readers have talked to me the most over the last year, and on which I have thought the most as well. What is now obvious to me, but was not at the time I wrote the tipping point, is that we are about to enter the age of word of mouth, and that, paradoxically, all of the sophistication and wizardry and limitless access to information of the new economy is going to lead us to rely more and more on very primitive kinds of social contacts. Relying on the connectors, mavens, and salesmen in our life is the way we deal with the complexity of the modern world. This is a function of many different factors and changes in our society, of which I'd like to talk about three. The rise of isolation, particularly among adolescents, the rise of immunity in communication, and the particularly critical role of the maven in the modern economy. Understanding the Age of Isolation. At 9:20 a.m. on March 5, 2001, 15-year-old Andy Williams opened fire with a .22-caliber long-barrel revolver from the bathroom of his high school in Santee, California. He fired 30 rounds over 6 minutes, first into the bathroom itself, and then into an adjoining courtyard, killing 2 students and hitting 13 other people. He was a skinny, jug-eared freshman, new to town, with a silver necklace reading Mouse. And afterward, as always seems to happen in these cases, his friends and teachers said they could not believe that someone so quiet and mild-mannered could have committed such an act of violence. I wrote in The Tipping Point about adolescent epidemics, and I used as a case study the epidemic of teenage suicide that raged for many years on the islands of Micronesia. I could not find a more dramatic example of the proclivity of teenagers to get caught up in mindless and highly contagious rituals of self-destruction. The Micronesian epidemic started with a single high-profile suicide, a love triangle involving a charismatic, highborn youth and a dramatic scene at a funeral. And soon other boys were committing suicide in precisely the same way, and for reasons that seemed preposterously trivial. I thought that the recent rise in teen smoking in the West was our form of this kind of epidemic. But in truth, the analogy was inexact. In Micronesia, teens were doing something entirely unique to their own culture. They were not mimicking an adult practice or reacting to something the adult world was imposing on them. They were simply following the internal rules of their culture, as if they were entirely blind to what adults said and did. Teen smoking, by contrast, is quite different. It's an adult practice that is cool among teens precisely because of its adult roots. And teens smoke, in part, in reaction to what adults preach to them about the evils of smoking. The first is an epidemic in isolation. The second is an epidemic in reaction. I thought we couldn't have the first kind of epidemic among Western teens. I was wrong. We now have the school shooting epidemic. The school massacre at Columbine High in Littleton, Colorado, happened on April 20, 1999. In the 22 months that followed, there were 19 separate incidents of school violence across the United States. 10 of them foiled, fortunately, before anyone got hurt. Each patterned almost eerily on the Columbine shootings. Seth Trickey, a seventh grader in Fort Gibson, Oklahoma, who pulled out a 9mm semi-automatic handgun and fired 15 rounds into a group of classmates in December of 1999, was so obsessed with the Columbine shootings that before the incident, he was receiving psychological counseling. A 17-year-old in Millbrae, California, was arrested after threatening to do a Columbine at his school. Police found an arsenal of 15 guns and rifles in his home. Joseph DeGuzman in Cupertino, California, planned an attack on his school in January of 2001 and later told police that the Columbine gunmen were the only thing that's real. Three boys were arrested in Kansas the following month, and police found bomb-making materials, rifles, and ammunition in their homes, including three black trench coats, just like the coats worn by the Columbine gunmen. 2 days later, in Fort Collins, Colorado, police found another cache of ammunition and guns. The boys involved had been overheard plotting to redo Columbine. In the press, this wave of shootings and would-be shootings has sometimes been portrayed as part of a larger wave of violence. But that's not true. In 1992 to 1993, there were 54 violent deaths on public school campuses around the United States. In 2000, there were 16. The Columbine wave happened in a period when violence among students was down, not up. Much attention has also been paid to the social circumstances of the children involved in those incidents. Andy Williams was a lonely and often bullied boy, the product of divorce and neglect. Time magazine summed up his world as a place where getting stoned on super-strong weed like bubblegum chronic is for some a daily deed, and where ditching school to rub shoulders with the Aryan Brothers gang in the skate park is an unexceptional life choice. But to have kids growing up in disaffection and loneliness is hardly a new development. Millions of kids who grew up just as emotionally impoverished as Andy Williams don't walk into their school one morning and start shooting. The difference is Columbine. Andy Williams was infected by the example of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, just as the suicides of Micronesia were infected by the example of that first dramatic love triangle. It is a mistake to try to make sense of these kinds of actions by blaming influences of the outside world, in terms of broader trends of violence and social breakdown. These are epidemics in isolation. They follow a mysterious internal script that makes sense only in the closed world that teenagers inhabit. The best analogy to this kind of epidemic is the outbreak of food poisoning that swept through several public schools in Belgium in the summer of 1999. It started when 42 children in the Belgian town of Bornem became mysteriously ill after drinking Coca-Cola and had to be hospitalized. 2 days later, 8 more school children fell sick in Brugge, followed by 13 in Harelbeke the next day, and 42 in Lochristi 3 days after that, and on in a widening spiral that, in the end, sent more than 100 children to the hospital, complaining of nausea, dizziness, and headaches, and forced Coca-Cola into the largest product recall in its 113-year history. Upon investigation, an apparent culprit was found. In the Coca-Cola plant in Antwerp, contaminated carbon dioxide had been used to carbonate a batch of the soda's famous syrup. But then the case got tricky. Upon examination, the contaminants in the carbon dioxide were found to be sulfur compounds present at between 5 and 17 parts per billion. These sulfides can cause illness, however, only at levels about 1,000 times greater than that. At 17 parts per billion, they simply impart a bad smell, like rotten eggs, which means that Belgium should have experienced nothing more than a minor epidemic of nose wrinkling. More puzzling is the fact that in 4 of the 5 schools where the bad Coke allegedly caused illness, half the kids who got sick hadn't actually drunk any Coke that day. Whatever went on in Belgium, in other words, probably wasn't Coca-Cola poisoning. So what was it? It was a kind of mass hysteria, a phenomenon that is not at all uncommon among schoolchildren. Simon Wesley, a psychiatrist at King's College of Medicine in London, has been collecting reports of this kind of hysteria for about 10 years, and now has hundreds of examples dating back as far as 1787, when mill workers in Lancashire suddenly took ill after they became persuaded that they were being poisoned by tainted cotton. According to Wesley, almost all cases fit a pattern. Someone sees a neighbor fall ill and becomes convinced that he is being contaminated by some unseen evil. In the past, it was demons and spirits. Nowadays, it tends to be toxins and gases, and his fear makes him anxious. His anxiety makes him dizzy and nauseated. He begins to hyperventilate. He collapses. Other people hear the same allegation, see the victim faint, and they begin to get anxious themselves. They feel nauseated. They hyperventilate. They collapse. And before you know it, everyone in the room is hyperventilating and collapsing. These symptoms, Wesley stresses, are perfectly genuine. It's just that they are manifestations of a threat that is wholly imagined. This kind of thing is extremely common, he says, and it's almost normal. It doesn't mean that you are mentally ill or crazy. What happened in Belgium was a fairly typical example of a more standard form of contagious anxiety, possibly heightened by the recent Belgian scare over dioxin-contaminated animal feed. The students' alarm over the rotten egg odor of their Cokes, for example, is straight out of the hysteria textbooks. The vast majority of these events are triggered by some abnormal but benign smell, Wesley said. Something strange, like a weird odor coming from the air conditioning. The fact that the outbreaks occurred in schools is also typical of hysteria cases. The classic ones always involve schoolchildren, Wesley continued. There's a famous British case involving hundreds of schoolgirls who collapsed during a 1980 Nottinghamshire jazz festival. They blamed it on a local farmer spraying pesticides. There have been more than 115 documented hysteria cases in schools over the past 300 years. Is it a mistake to take the hysterical outbreaks, like the Belgian Coke scare, too seriously? Not at all. It was, in part, a symptom of deeper underlying anxieties. What's more, the children who felt sick were not faking their symptoms. They were sick. It's just that it's important to realize that sometimes epidemic behavior among children does not have an identifiable and rational cause. The kids get sick because other kids got sick. The post-Columbine outbreak of school shootings is, in this sense, no different. It is happening because Columbine happened, and because ritualized, dramatic, self-destructive behavior among teenagers, whether it involves suicide, smoking, taking a gun to school, or fainting after drinking a harmless can of Coke, has extraordinary contagious power. My sense is that the way adolescent society has evolved in recent years has increased the potential for this kind of isolation. We have given teens more money so they can construct their own social and material worlds more easily. We have given them more time to spend among themselves and less time in the company of adults. We have given them email and beepers and, most of all, cellular phones, so that they can fill in all the dead spots in their day, dead spots that might once have been filled with the voices of adults, with the voices of their peers. That is a world ruled by the logic of word of mouth, by the contagious messages that teens pass among themselves. Columbine is now the most prominent epidemic of isolation among teenagers. It will not be the last. Beware the rise of immunity. One of the things I didn't talk about much in The Tipping Point, but which I have been asked about over and over again, is the effect of the internet, in particular email, on my ideas about word of mouth. Surely, after all, email seems to make the role of the connector obsolete, or at least changes it dramatically. Email makes it possible for almost anyone to keep up with lots and lots of people. In fact, email does make it possible to cheaply and effectively reach people, or customers, whom you might not know at all. Kevin Kelly, one of the gurus of the new economy, has written, for example, of what he calls the fax effect, which is a version of this argument. The first fax machine ever made was the result of millions of dollars of research and development and cost about $2,000 at retail. But it was worth nothing, because there was no other fax machine for it to communicate with. The second fax machine made the first fax more valuable, and the third fax made the first two more valuable, and so on. Because fax machines are linked into a network, each additional fax machine that is shipped increases the value of all the fax machines operating before it, Kelly writes. When you buy a fax machine, then, what you are really buying is access to the entire fax network, which is infinitely more valuable than the machine itself. Kelly calls this the fax effect, or the law of plentitude, and he considers it an extraordinarily radical notion. In the traditional economy, after all, value comes from scarcity. The conventional icons of wealth, diamonds, gold, are precious because they are rare. And when something scarce becomes plentiful, as oil did in the 1980s and 1990s, it loses value. But the logic of the network is exactly the opposite. Power and value now come from abundance. The more copies you make of your software, the more people you add to your network, the more powerful it becomes. This is why email is supposed to be so powerful. It's the ultimate tool for easily creating these kinds of personal networks. But is this true? Epidemics create networks as well. A virus moves from one person to another, spreading through a community, and the more people a virus infects, the more powerful the epidemic is. But this is also why epidemics so often come to a crashing halt. Once you've had a particular strain of the flu or the measles, you develop an immunity to it. And when too many people get immunity to a particular virus, the epidemic comes to an end. I think that when we talk about social epidemics, we give far too little attention to the problem of immunity. In the late 1970s, for instance, businesses began to realize that the phone was a really cheap and efficient way of reaching potential customers. And since then, the number of telemarketing calls to target households has increased tenfold. This sounds like a very good example of what Kelly is talking about, the extraordinary economic potential of a communications network that we all belong to. Except that in certain key respects, the explosion in phone use doesn't sound like the law of plentitude at all. The fact that everyone has a phone makes the phone network very powerful, in theory. But the truth is that over the past 25 years or so, the effectiveness of telemarketing has dropped by about 50%. Certain low-ticket items, things that cost in the range of $25 to $30, such as magazine subscriptions, are simply no longer economical to market over the phone. Belonging to a large network may be a wonderful thing, And the larger networks are, theoretically, the more powerful they are. As a network grows in size, however, it is also the case that the time and nuisance costs borne by each member of the network grow as well. That's why people don't talk to telemarketers anymore, and why most of us have answering machines and caller ID that lets us screen calls. The phone network is so large and unwieldy that we are increasingly only interested in using it selectively. We are getting immune to the telephone. Is email any different? I remember when I first got email back in the mid-1990s. I would rush home with great anticipation and dial in on my 4800 baud modem, and I would have 4 messages from 4 very good friends. And what would I do? I would immediately compose long, elegant responses. Now, of course, I get up in the morning and go to my computer, and I have 64 messages. And the anticipation I once felt has been replaced by dread. I receive unwanted spam email and forwarded stories and jokes that I have no interest in, and people I don't particularly care about email me to ask me to do things I don't want to do. So how do I respond? I compose very, very short emails, seldom more than 2 lines long, and I often take 2 or 3 days to get back to people, and lots of email I don't answer at all. I suspect the same thing is happening with other email users around the world. The more email we get, the shorter and more selective and more delayed our responses become. These are the symptoms of immunity. What makes email so susceptible to immunity is the very thing that initially made it seem so attractive to people like Kevin Kelly, how easy and inexpensive it was to reach people. In one recent study, for instance, psychologists found that groups who communicate electronically deal with dissenting opinions very differently than groups who meet face-to-face. People holding dissenting opinions expressed their arguments most frequently and persistently when they communicated online, the researchers concluded. At the same time, minorities received the highest level of positive attention and had the greatest influence on the private opinions of members in the majority and on the final group decision when they communicated face-to-face. The fact that expressing a dissenting view in person is much harder socially, in other words, gives that opinion much more credence in the group's deliberations. It's the same way in other kinds of communications. The fact that anyone can email us for free, if they have our address, means that people frequently and persistently email us. But that quickly creates immunity and simply makes us value face-to-face communications and the communications of those we already know and trust, all the more. I think that the facts effect error is being repeated by marketers and communicators over and over again. Advertising agencies often decide which magazines and television shows they want to place their ads in on the basis of cost. They buy whatever time is the cheapest as a means of reaching the widest possible audience. But what about immunity? The agency's logic has resulted in so many companies buying ads on television that it now runs more hours of commercial time than ever before. Therefore, it's hard to believe that people are really watching commercials as closely as they did before. The same is true for a magazine with hundreds of advertisements or a roadside with billboards every 100 feet. When people are overwhelmed with information and develop immunity to traditional forms of communication, they turn instead for advice and information to the people in their lives whom they respect, admire, and trust. The cure for immunity is finding mavens, connectors, and salesmen. Finding the mavens. Whenever I look at an unopened bar of Ivory bath soap, I flip it over and burst out laughing. In the midst of all the product information, there's a line that says, "Questions? Comments? Call 1-800-395-9960. Who on earth could ever have a question about Ivory soap? In fact, who on earth would ever have a question about Ivory soap so important that they felt compelled to call the company right away? The answer, of course, is that while most of us would never dial that number, a very small percentage of profoundly weird people may well feel compelled from time to time to call in with a question. These are people who feel passionate about soap. They are the soap mavens. And if you're in the soap business, you'd better treat those soap mavens well, because they are the ones whom all their friends turn to for advice about soap. The Ivory Soap 800 number is what I call a maven trap, a way of efficiently figuring out who the mavens are in a particular world. And how to set maven traps is one of the central problems facing the modern marketplace. For the better part of a century, we defined influence in this country in the form of status. The most important influence in making up our minds, we were told, was the people who made the most money and who had the most education and who lived in the choicest neighborhoods. The virtue of this notion was that these kinds of people were easy to find. In fact, an entire industry in the marketing world was created around the convenient delivery of long lists of people who had graduate degrees, made lots of money, and lived in nice neighborhoods. But connectors, mavens, and salesmen are a little different. They are distinguished not by worldly status and achievement, but by the particular standing they have among their friends. People look up to them not out of envy, but out of love, which is why these kinds of personalities have the power to break through the rising tide of isolation and immunity. But love is a very difficult thing to track. How on earth do you find these kinds of people? This is a question that I've been asked again and again over the last year, and there is no easy answer. Connectors, I think, are the sorts of people who don't need to be found. They make it their business to find you. But mavens are a little harder, which is why it is so important, I think, to come up with strategies for finding mavens. Maven traps. Consider the experience of Lexus. In 1990, just after Lexus first introduced its line of luxury cars in the United States, the company realized that it had two minor problems with its LS400 line that required a recall. The situation was, by any measure, an awkward one. Lexus had decided, from the beginning, to build its reputation around quality workmanship and reliability. And now, within little more than a year of the brand's launch, the company was being forced to admit to problems with its flagship. So Lexus decided to make a special effort. Most recalls are handled by making an announcement to the press and mailing a notification letter to owners. Lexus, instead, called each owner individually on the telephone the day the recall was announced. When the owners picked up their cars at the dealership after the work was completed, each car had been washed and the tank filled with gas. If an owner lived more than 100 miles from a dealership, the dealership sent a mechanic to his or her home. In one instance, a technician flew from Los Angeles to Anchorage to make the necessary repairs. Was it necessary to go to such lengths? You could argue that Lexus overreacted. The problems with the car were relatively minor, and the number of cars involved in the recall, so soon after Lexus had entered the marketplace, was small. Lexus would seem to have had many opportunities to correct the damage. The key fact, though, was not the number of people affected by the recall, but the kind of people affected by the recall. Who, after all, are the people willing to take a chance and buy a brand new luxury model? Car mavens. There may have been only a few thousand Lexus owners at that point, but they were car experts, people who take cars seriously, people who talk about cars, people whose friends ask them for advice about cars. Lexus realized that it had a captive audience of mavens, and that if they went the extra mile, they could kickstart a word-of-mouth epidemic about the quality of their customer service. And that's just what happened. The company emerged from what could have been a disaster with a reputation for customer service that continues to this day. One automotive publication later called it the perfect recall. This is the perfect maven trap. Using the recognition that sometimes a specific time or place or situation happens to bring together a perfect maven audience. Here's another example, one that a reader of The Tipping Point, Bill Hartigan, told me about in an email. Hartigan was working for AT&T Financial Services in the early 1970s, right at the moment when the entire industry was first being allowed to market the then unknown IRA, Individual Retirement Account. It was a market AT&T ended up dominating. Why? Because they were the first to find a group of mavens. As Hartigan writes, "The concept of giving your money to an institution until you were at least 59 and a half years old then seemed strange and scary. But one interesting thing about those IRAs, even until the mid-70s, tax breaks were only for the wealthy. This was the exception. Knowing that was our key to success. Target the wealthy? Nope. There are never many of them. They are too hard to see, and the benefits of IRAs probably would be of muted appeal. One potential target group stood out like a sore thumb, though. Teachers. At the time, and to this day, unfortunately, this vital group of professionals was overworked and severely underpaid. No one ever sought the advice of a teacher when the topic was tax breaks and investing. But IRAs allowed teachers many similar benefits that heretofore had only been for the wealthy. It benefited them today and tomorrow. As the great sports writer Red Smith once wrote, "Fighters fight, and teachers, they teach." They quickly caught on to the benefits of what IRAs had to offer them. Just as quickly, human nature took over. For the first time ever, they were able to talk to Johnny's parents about how they handled their money. Talk about grooming an entire market. Still the most brilliant marketing strategy that I have ever been involved with. Is there a way of finding the mavens in every market? I don't know, although I am quite sure that there are readers who will use The Tipping Point as the inspiration to come up with a way. In a world dominated by isolation and immunity, understanding these principles of word of mouth is more important than ever.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference, written by Malcolm Gladwell and read by the author. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. Text abridged by Kim Grunenfelder and edited by William Whittington. Production coordinated by Dennis Kao. Tape edited, mixed, and mastered by Rick Dasher, North Hollywood Sound. The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference, is also available in hardcover from Little Brown & Company.